a dispute about the election itself is very fundamental to this, because one of the things that's absolutely necessary, given the divisions in the country, is confidence in the election system itself, that the people who win the elections have legitimately won the elections. I may not disagree with them, but my job is to overcome the fact that my view is in the minority. If I believe my view is in the majority and I've simply been done out of the victory I think my party has won, I'm likely to be a very angry person and angry about the political system. And we've seen some of that in the January 6th events, for instance. People who have been told that the system is illegitimate are likely to take actions that are exceedingly dangerous to the stability of the society.
Welcome to Management Matters, the award-winning National Academy of Public Administration podcast, where policy meets practice. I'm Terry Girton, president of the Academy. In October, we focus on our grand challenge to ensure electoral integrity and enhance voter participation. In this episode, I'll be talking with Academy Fellows Joel Auerbach and Bert Rockman about their new paper on the American right and the federal executive. Dr. Auerbach is Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Political Science and Public Policy at the University of California, Los Angeles. Dr. Rockman is the Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Purdue University. Joel and Bert, thanks so much for joining me today. I mentioned at the intro this chapter that you all have written for an upcoming book, and the title of your chapter is The American Right and the Federal Executive, and it examines the history of how conservative or Republican presidents have approached the management of the executive branch. It's a very interesting topic as we're about to embark, or maybe already into, another presidential election cycle. So Joel, let me start with you, because the chapter starts with Jefferson, Hamilton, and Madison. How did their different theories on government functions impact our original government design?
Well, Jefferson represents the populist elements of political culture in the United States. His notion was we should have minimal government. There were elements of libertarianism in it. And the notion, again, was that power should flow upward. But the real crucial founding father from the perspective of government institutions is Madison. And he was an institution builder, and he wanted to develop a system that a rather famous historian described as a harmonious system of mutual frustration. And anybody watching television these days and seeing the House of Representatives knows exactly what that means.
Not so harmonious.
The harmonious part. But in any event, the notion was that there would be separation of powers, an executive branch, a legislative branch, a judicial branch, federalisms. So you have states as well as the federal government. They would each have a set of enumerated powers, and they would need one another to govern. In the clashes between them, as well as the bargaining, there would arise a consensus of sorts about what should be done. Everyone would, if the system's working well, be getting something. That's the harmonious part. And they wouldn't be getting everything they want. That's the mutual frustration part.
At the time, though, there weren't really the party identifications to go with these folks. So, Bert, you talked about the shifting priorities of the two major parties and the rise and fall of third parties over time. And as we're having sort of a conversation about whether now is the time to introduce a third party, what's important to understand about the history of these realignments that gives context to our political environment today?
Well, a realignment tends to occur. In fact, there's some question as to precisely what a realignment is, but realignments tend to occur over the course of usually a few generations. And they are the consequence typically of a basically big change in society or a crisis in particular. So we've had one immediately after the Civil War, basically, that put the Republicans in power, although it was sort of touch and go. We had a lot of divided government at the time. And then we had another realignment that strengthened the Republicans' hand approximately around the 1896 election. And then the one that's probably been most relevant for the development of the administrative state in the U.S. was the New Deal realignment of the 1930s. And that really began substantially the development of what we might think of as the administrative state. And in fact, it was the Brownlow Commission that basically indicated that the president needed help to help manage this growing apparatus. We got another big shot of this during the Johnson administration and so on. So crisis is what basically is the causal mechanism of political realignments. Now, that means that voters have shifted to some degree, or new generations of voters have come up, and they have tended to vote for the same party, though the reasons, their reasons or motives for doing so may differ quite a bit from the motives that the now elected politicians have. So we have traditionally, as the Republicans have been in the position of managing the administrative state, traditionally Democrats have favored social service agencies, as we discovered during the three times we basically interviewed the federal executive, and Republicans have tended to favor national security and law enforcement agencies. What seems to have happened is that in the Trump Republican era, that those agencies that were favored by Republicans have fallen out of favor among Republicans as well. So the party has tended to become largely anti-institutionalist in this sense. That is one that basically seems to be against the administrative state, no matter what it's administering.
So just to follow up and make sure we're all tracking on the same terms, when you say the administrative state, Joel, I'm thinking back to what you said about Madison and institution building, right? That the administrative state is the group of agencies, and Bert, you just enumerated some of them, that help the president do the job of the executive, right? And that in the past, the Republicans supported some parts of the administrative state, and the Democrats seem to be aligned more with the other part of the administrative state. And now we have the parties kind of shifting alignment on which parts, if any, of the administrative state they support. So when you think about the voters underneath all of that, how does that get translated to the voting population?
Well, a lot depends on the institution we're talking about. For instance, the Republicans have now become opponents of an institution like the FBI. In a past generation or a past political generation, the FBI was the darling of the Republican Party because it was doing the sorts of things that they wanted done, or that most of them wanted done. And the left, what passes for the left in the United States, the Democratic Party, was more skeptical of the FBI, particularly in the period searching out communists and the government and whatever. You wouldn't recognize today the comments that the Republican elected officials make about the FBI, or at least the Trump-influenced Republicans, because now the FBI are the, look what they did. They tried to keep Trump from being president, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, we're all familiar with the public stuff. So it's a total change across the same institution.
So that's one of the things that I found so fascinating about my advanced read of your chapter, is that you're able to track the changing tides of these alignments. This is not the first time that the parties have realigned around which pieces of the executive branch or the administrative state that they support. In fact, that realignment has been almost constant over the history of our nation.
Because it depends on the constituency of the party and the needs of the leaders. I mean, they're both factors come into it. And of course, with the FBI, I mean, it's the most fundamental thing. Who's going to hold the office? They have gotten themselves enmeshed in that rather uncomfortable debate that's gone on in the country now for quite a while.
Well, speaking about these shifting tides, there's another piece of this that I would love to hear your thoughts on, because in the public administration field, we typically consider the concept of neutral competence of federal civil servants as a good value. Mm-hmm. But in your paper, you raise the idea of responsive competence. And so I'd love to hear, Joel, let's start with you. Talk about these two framings, neutral competence and responsive competence. How are they similar? How are they different? And why are they so important today?
Well, neutral competence emphasizes predictability and legal grounding to governance, to govern in accordance with the law, so that civil servants are supposed to provide careful and objective analysis of what the statutes require, to administer the law in a neutral way, to analyze programs as objectively as possible. In other words, to be neutral servants of the of governance and of the government. Responsive competence emphasizes doing what political leaders want them to do without necessarily paying that much attention to predictability, to due process, even to what the statutes might seem to say on their face, in order to produce what the political leader wants. And so responsive competence appeals often to elected officials and to appointed officials at the top of the government, but it may not appeal all that much to civil servants who think that they are serving the broader needs of the state and of the population at large and following the laws and regulations as they've been written. And this is a tension that's been there for quite a while. I think in the questions Bert's going to address, we're going to talk about the Nixon administration and some other things that are related to responsive competence. But just as an example of something that I'm sure rankled a lot of people, Trump used to refer to the military people as my generals. Like they belonged, he not only was commander in chief, but they were there to do what he wanted, as opposed to a broader interpretation of what their mission might be, or the FBI for that matter. The accusations about the deep state is this accusation that the FBI had somehow become a tool of the Democratic Party and responsive to them, as opposed to carrying out the law or the regulations as they'd been written.
Just to follow up on that, if I could, there's a tendency for all chief executives, I think, to want, and even politicians in Congress, obviously, to want the bureaucracy to be responsive to their particular interests and their particular constituencies. And there's a kind of possessive quality of this that goes beyond Trump. Lyndon Johnson, when he was in an American military base in the Philippines, I think it was 1966 or so, was being guided to his aircraft by a soldier. He said, "This is your plane, Mr. President." And Johnson responded, "Son, these are all my planes."
Well, Bert, that's a great lead in to the next question I have for you, because you point out in the paper that all presidents, regardless of party, tend to view the bureaucracy really through three lenses: their own personal political self-interest, their ideologies, and their party's political constituencies. So you just gave us that example of Johnson, who said, you know, all of the military assets are my assets. But are there some other examples about how those three priorities mix to influence government structure and process?
Yeah, I think generally speaking, it's they're more reinforcing than antagonistic. That is, a president is going to see basically a constituency interests in terms of how he or she can basically create a more powerful support base. They're also going to, I think, see some ideological consistency between them and their constituency, political constituency base in their party. I think that they're, and of course, that's going to be in the president's self-interest as well, to have basically all the so-called political ducks in a row. But there are moments where these elements can be somewhat antagonistic, but mostly they're reinforcing. Now, a few presidents, as we point out, seem to be ideologically dedicated to a particular perspective of the administration. Ronald Reagan, I think, was a pretty good case in point, trying basically to cut back government in, not in general, he expanded government in the Defense Department, for example, mm-hmm. but tried to cut it back in agencies that fit with the then Republican idea of a wasted spending, so to speak. Clinton, I think, also, however, sought what he called the third way constituency as a form of constituency building, that kind of creating this middle, so to speak. And as a consequence, he did have some conflicts with his political party in that respect. Others, Nixon and Trump particularly, perceived the institutional government, as I think Joel pointed out, to be working against them. Notably, the language during the Trump administration of the deep state and draining the swamp. And each, both Nixon and Trump, notably overstepped the bounds of procedural regularity and law. One of the things we want to emphasize is the current polarization of politics with non-overlapping constituencies leads to a heightened desire for complete political control on the part of the president. And as the parties have become farther and farther apart, presidents want to basically control as much as they can, because the fact is that these constituencies are non-overlapped. And the whole idea of, as Joel explained, of the Madisonian framework was essentially that we would have overlapped constituencies and the ability to compromise. And that seems to have gone out the window for a while now.
We're sort of seeing not even overlapping constituencies within the parties these days.
Yes. That's actually more on the Republican side at the moment than the Democrats. But it's always, you're always able to be unified in opposition. Governing is another matter.
Changes, though, are really huge over the last 20 or 30 years, because I go back to the Nixon administration or Nixon running for president, where he used what they called the Southern strategy. Mm-hmm. And the notion, I think, as Bert pointed out to me the other day, the slogan was going hunting where the ducks are. And the ducks were in the South during the effort to start integration and racial equality and the rest of it, and the rest of that program. So what happened was that this overlapping electoral result, where you had Southern conservatives who were Democrats and Northern liberals, Western liberals who were also Democrats, in the same chamber, often on the same committees, representing the same parties, they had to bargain with one another to get legislation through. And that was what we mean by a kind of overlapping mm-hmm. constituency. And now things have separated a great deal. The South is now Republican. Also, the religious groups were previously much more friendly to the Democratic Party than they are now. There are major changes sociologically and in the society that have become institutionalized in the parties as well. And so you have just what Bert was talking about, this notion that people representing the other side are actually not potential friends. They're pretty much permanent opponents. And that's a very different situation politically than the Madisonian system imagined we would have.
Right. Back again to frustration, but without the harmony in it.
Yes.
So I'm going to remember that harmonious frustration. As you're talking about these political lines hardening, you also talk in the paper about how presidents use centralization and politicization to get control of the bureaucracy, and that those approaches have been increasing since the Nixon presidency as well. What happens when presidents use those tools? Do they really work? Do they get more control? Does it just feel like they have more control?
Well, they have problems. Nixon, one of the things that they did in the Nixon administration was to try to move control of the agencies into the White House with appointees whose job it was to oversee the administrative agencies. That didn't work very well because they weren't getting good information out of the agencies, probably rightfully felt they were being sabotaged, actually, by a lot of the career civil servants, but also even some of Nixon's own appointees. It's hard for them because the civil servants, the sorts of people who make government a career in a particular agency, are also usually attached to the program that they're actually administering. They believe in it. They think they're doing good. And so when the political hierarchy tries to change what's happening, particularly when the law has not been changed, they're likely to get resistance from the bottom. And the resistance comes not necessarily in the form of absolute sabotage, but in the form of actually following what the law might imply or even say overtly the program is supposed to be doing and the civil servants are supposed to be doing. So it becomes a really difficult interpersonal situation, and you get this kind of talk too about the swamp, the civil servants as somehow the enemies of the people in a variety of forms that follows from this kind of change that's taken place and from the kind of tension that exists, that can exist.
It sounds like that takes us back to the conversation of neutral versus responsive competence and the tension that creates. So when a president might try to politicize or centralize an agency, that the civil servants in that organization fall back to neutral competence as opposed to responsive competence. A fair statement. I just keep thinking as you all are talking that it's such a good reminder for the times we live in to recall that these trends are not just from the last 4 or 5 years, that they've been present for almost the full life of our country. And so, Bert, as we think about this, your paper draws a through line, for me at least, between the shifting priorities of the Republican Party and the actions of Republican presidents related to the federal bureaucracy. And you talk specifically from Wilson to Trump. But I guess my question now, as we're looking at this next presidential election cycle, is what does that trend line mean for the future? What are the implications of your findings to the political environment and the presidential election that are ahead of us?
Well, I think a relevant answer to that might be exactly where we are in terms of the progression of this trend, or whether we're looking at a possible change in the political atmosphere. And that's rather hard to predict, but if I were making a judgment currently, I would say that we already have a substantial problem of low confidence in government, and it's likely that we're closer to the beginning of this malaise than its resolution, which is a really worrisome observation, if true. And I think, as a former scholar of public administration, as well as a former president, that's not me, by the way, once observed, effective administration is dependent upon stability and predictability. And we're in an environment that is anything but that. So moderating these differences does not seem likely in whatever future I can foresee, though it may eventually be the product of a very high level of tension. We'll see about that. But it's not likely that the battle for political control over the administrative state will diminish, as I think we see it. And the tactics, therefore, of the Trump presidency and even his out-of-office activity, some of those emanating from the halls of Congress, could be more of a beginning than an end of the fierce tactics of a highly competitive political struggle.
Well, and Joel, as you look at the situation, what do you see for the future?
Well, I agree with what Bert said, and I think a dispute about the election itself is very fundamental to this, because one of the things that's absolutely necessary, given the divisions in the country, is confidence in the election system itself, that the people who win the elections have legitimately won the elections. I may not disagree with them, but my job is to overcome the fact that my view is in the minority. If I believe my view is in the majority and I've simply been done out of the victory I think my party has won, I'm likely to be a very angry person and angry about the political system. And we've seen some of that in the, you know, the January 6th events, for instance. People who have been told that the system is illegitimate are likely to take actions that are exceedingly dangerous to the stability of the society. So it's we're at an inflection point. I think it's really absolutely essential that anything that can be done to make sure that the electoral system is legitimate should be done, and done as quickly as possible, because otherwise we're going to have bigger problems.
Well, thank you in that for bringing us back to our grand challenge about ensuring electoral integrity and enhancing voter participation. And as you both have articulated, as we look ahead, this is a really important election cycle, and the preservation of our nation may just hinge on how that comes out. And so I really appreciate the service you have done in this paper about reminding us of the history of these transitions and realignments and how important they are when we think about the work of government that's ahead and the people who need to do it with neutral competence along the way. So not only hunting where the ducks are and neutral competence, but harmonious frustration. That's what we're striving for. Never really thought that would be on the ballot, but here it is.
So Joe and I are members of the Optimists Club.
Perfect. That is a perfect place to leave this conversation. Joel and Bert, thank you so much for sharing your paper and your long lessons of history with us. And thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you very much, Terry.
You, our pleasure.
For our listeners, check back every Monday for a new episode from the Academy as we work to build a just, fair, and inclusive government that strengthens communities and protects democracy.